Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1346. Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 20. Count them, 20. This is being recorded on September 1st of the year 2024. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to reintroduce to the audience Monty, my new co-host. And we have been talking, we are undergoing what could be called a pivot to Asia. We're going to be exploring things that took place in Asia. By the way, one of the topics I forgot, we won't talk about this right now. I forgot to mention when I was giving the outset. That is Jim Wilcott. He was a guy who basically wrote a pay voucher for Lee Harvey Oswald, but the people around him, the people he was working with, were Japanese fascists. I forgot to mention that, but we'll get to that in time.
For sure.
But we are pivoting to Asia. Now, we've been talking about operations. Sunrise, names very familiar to the audience, like Carl Wolf, Hajime Malhousseini, Otto Ernst Rehmer, François Genoux, really important. And by the way, the heir to the political last will and testament and collective writings of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels, people like Alois Brunner, Hjalmar Horace Greeley, Schott, Otto Ernst Rehmer, Johann von Leers, Omar Amin von Leers. All names familiar to the veteran listeners and all searchable in the database, but we are talking about a pivot to Asia. Now, Mr. Bloom was a key aide to Dulles, and so we're talking about Operation Sunrise, and we will be seeing how the sun rises in Asia, so to speak. They call Japan the land of the rising sun. So here we go. Hello, Monty.
Yes, sir.
Okay, you're up here.
Oh, excuse me. Well, I'd like to turn the listeners' attention to a short blurb from a book called Scoop. And it was published in paperback, in 2006, by James H. Walters. And the publishing house for that is Create Space Independent Pub, once again published in 2006.
Now, is this Stoop, S-T-O-O-P, or Scoop, S-C-O-O-P?
Scoop, S-C-O-O-P.
Very good. Go ahead.
And just to give a little bit of background on it, this is the I'm just reading the blurb directly off of Amazon. It states the following information. Gializino Ciano, the last name spelled on that is C-I-A-N-O. So Ciano, a Mussolini's son-in-law and Italy's foreign minister, kept a diary of every important discussion of Axis leaders during the war. Mussolini ordered Ciano's execution. Then Ciano's wife, Edda, her name is spelled E-D-D-A, smuggled the diary to Switzerland, where the Chicago Daily News got a microfilm copy. The microfilm was carried secretly to Chicago, where it was published by the Daily News and syndicated around the world with great success. So that's essentially the blurb of the materials we're going to be reading from.
Can you spell Mussolini's relative force? Does that count Ciano?
Correct. The full name on that is spelling on that is Gialezzo. Last name is Ciano.
Very good. Thank you.
This is a blurb involving an OSS officer by the name of Cordelia Hood. Her name before she was married was Dodson, D-O-D-S-O-N. And she was a counterintelligence agent. Once again, another counterespionage operative, just like Paul Bloom, who served in the Office of Strategic Services during the Second World War in Europe, primarily in Switzerland. And she was actually the wife of William J. Hood, who was the former CIA station chief in Frankfurt, and then later in Berlin, serving under Reinhard Galland in the 1950s. And, of course, this is the exact same William J. Hood who later became one of the top covert action officers in the Western Hemisphere under David Attlee Phillips. So this is actually the wife of William J. Hood. Once again, Cordelia Hood. Full spelling on her name is C-O-R-D-E-L-I-A. HOOD for her last name. And of course, her the name we're referencing here is her maiden name, Dodson. Dodson. So reading from the book once again, Scoop. This is a blurb about Dodson's activities with the OSS. And let's see. Quote, she had no papers permitting her to escort them to Switzerland. This is a reference to Dodson's activities escorting a couple of defectors from Nazi command. 2 days later in Lyon, Dodson was able to hitch a ride for herself and her friends in an army command and reconnaissance car that her OSS colleague had commandeered to escort his agents to the German border. Her cover was simple. She was his French girlfriend, and that was to act accordingly if halted en route to the border. Their main fear was the edgy French Marquis units on the lookout for escaping Germans as the Battle of the Bulge raged on to the west.
That would be Marquis, Maquis,
a name Marquis,
for the,
excuse me, yes.
For the French resistance. Continue.
Right. The trip took half a day. Reading again. The trip took half a day of steady driving on bomb-scarred roads through bitter winter weather. Finally, they reached the Swiss border at Saint-Leu. Across the darkness was Geneva and the safety of neutral Switzerland. Here, Dodson and her two charges disembarked on the border station and waved goodbye as the command car headed towards Germany. I couldn't believe we had finally made it, Dodson later recalled. How did we get to Geneva from the border town? The Swiss called a taxi, of course. Switzerland was a time warp in the war-torn continent of Europe. It was almost stodgy in a self-discontented way, well-stocked with food and drink, and a bright contrast to Dodson's London post, where winter winds had whistled through her bomb-cracked office walls and where she had to wear mittens with fingertips cut out in order to facilitate typing. Switzerland's towns were intact, she recalled. We drove at night with the lights on. In Geneva, that evening, we dined at the elegant restaurant where martinis were served in proper glasses, not paper cups and napkins, where real linen, not Kleenex. The dinner was superb and the wine was excellent. Later, we took the train to Bern. It was a comfortable, smooth ride, and we actually arrived on time.
Bern, by the way, was where Alan Dulles was stationed in World War II. Yes, BERME. Continue, Marty.
Right. What Dodson found when she got to Bern was a quaint medieval city with shopping arcades, cobbled streets, busy hotels and restaurants, bright germaniums, and window boxes outside sandstone. An ornate clock tower in the center of town. It was the perfect location which Alan Dulles would run an espionage organization that stretched into Nazi Germany to Austria, Yugoslavia, Hungary, Romania, France, and Italy. Dodson's boss, Paul Blum, once again, the spelling on that last name is B-L-U-M, met her at a key station in Bern on December 22, 1944. He handed her a key to her own private apartment in a hotel overlooking the AR River, which told her, overlooking the AR River and told her that he was looking forward to working with her.
How was the name of that river spelled?
A-A-R-E.
Okay, thank you.
Dodson remembered Blum as a charming gentleman. He was 46 years old at the time in 1944, chief of Bern's newly established counter-espionage or X2 branch. Earlier, he had set up counterintelligence branches in Lisbon, Portugal, Madrid, Spain, and worked for the London X2 branch chief, Winston McKinley Scott, where Dodson had briefly met him.
And, of course, Winscott is someone we spoke about at great length, networking with Max Egan von Hohenlohe in the immediate after, well, actually when he was with the OSS, when they were the SSU, and later when Winscott was chief of was CIA station chief in Mexico City, he was working with Max Egan von Hohenlohe and Los Tecos, and the use of the Mexican Nazi organization as propagandists and as active fronts. Continue, Monty.
Absolutely. Reading again. Dodson remembered Blum as a charming gentleman. He was 46 at the time, chief of Byrne's newly established counterespionage, or X2 branch. Earlier, he had set up counterintelligence branches in Lisbon, Portugal, Madrid, Spain, and worked in London's X2 branch under Winston McKinley Scott, where Dotson had met him briefly. Bloom was born in Japan to an American mother and a French father. After graduating from Yale, he went into the import-export business, becoming a world traveler in later years and a collector of Orientalia. His French was perfect, as was his Japanese. As a teenager during the First World War, he had been awarded the Croix de Guerre for driving an ambulance in France. Bloom was later made contact with German officers in northern Italy on the secret surrender operation engineered by Alan Dulles, codename Operation Sunrise. With the help of business contacts he had worked with before the war, Bloom and his staff were able to trace the deposits of Nazi gold from Germany and watch them covertly appear in banks in France, Spain, and finally South America. Dotson helped him chart these huge amounts of bullion clandestinely moved from the collapsing Reich. Thus, Dotson was in the right place at the right time to help Dulles get documents that were left hidden in Italy, pertaining to the surreptitiously moved Nazi war bullion, first from northern Italy and then into banks located in Liechtenstein.
Liechtenstein could be thought of as a lean, mean, money laundering machine. It's a tiny nation of only about 30-some thousand people, 32,000 people. Prince Hans Adam, who was the head of state there for a long time, is actually a member of the Habsburg family. So Liechtenstein is basically inextricably linked with the Habsburgs. And what you're talking about, Monty, with the exfiltration of these huge amounts of Nazi gold, is the counteraction of Operation Safe Haven, the attempt at interdicting the Nazi flight capital program. And that places American operatives very centrally involved in that Nazi flight capital operation. Go ahead.
Right. I should note that the counterespionage commander, just as an editorial, since you mentioned Operation Safe Haven, the counterespionage commander for Operation Safe Haven in Germany, before he was transferred to OSS operations in China, the commander of Operation Safe Haven that was initially tracking the Nazi war loot and, I believe it was at least 900 front companies that were set up by Martin Bormann to protect Nazi assets. The chief of counterespionage was a man by the name of Paul Leonel Edward Helliwell. Okay.
Obviously a name we have spoken about at great length. And there's a good discussion of the 750 corporate front set up by Bormann and how that intersects with the contemporary economic and political landscape in the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, that is available for download for free. Not only on the SpitfireList.com website, but on the 32-gigabyte flash drive with all of my life's work on it. And by the way, this fall, there will be a new flash drive, including the interviews with Monty, that will be available. We have exceeded 32 gigabytes, though, so there will be a new flash drive coming out this fall. So, and I get no money whatsoever from this. So listeners to this should be on the alert to get the flash drive when it is available. And again, I get no money whatsoever from this. So maybe people shouldn't worry about violating FCC regs on that. Continue, Monty.
Right. So ultimately, that is the position that Paul Bloom occupies. Not only is he acting as an attaché for the commander of all OSS operations in Switzerland, but he's also the chief of counterespionage. He's the commander of all operations tracking Nazi war loot being moved out of Germany, but with an emphasis on Italy. He's specifically tracking the Nazi war loot moving out of Italy for Operation Sunrise. But he's also an attaché for Operation Sunrise, okay? And as I pointed out earlier, thanks to Claudia Hood and her report on Paul Bloom, It should be noted that he previously had set up counter-espionage networks for the OSS in Thailand, Portugal, Madrid, and then finally he was stationed to Switzerland in October of 1944. Okay. And he worked there all the way up into the spring of 1947, where he acted as a subordinate to Alan Dulles. So from October 1944 to spring of 1947, Paul Bloom is a direct subordinate to Alan Dulles. Now I'd like to pivot to a, National Archives Interagency Working Group document. This is can be found in National Archives. But
before you do, Monty, I do want to mention that Lisbon and Portugal are very significant because Enrique Salazar, although Lisbon, Portugal was nominally neutral, Enrique Salazar, the dictator of Portugal, was a fascist and supported Francisco Franco. And the Bretton Woods Conference set up Macau, a Portuguese colony in Asia, in China, as a gold laundering center. So these connections are very significant and track forward to this day. Continue, please.
Right. And it should just be noted that so Findus, the covert supply lines for the Third Reich before, during, and after the Second World War, not only were their operations being run out of Madrid, but they're also being run out of Lisbon. Okay, so ultimately Spain and Portugal are not neutral entities, even though the official histories of the Second World War always erroneously identify them as neutral. In fact, I would argue, just on a personal aside here, Dave, and perhaps you can back me up on this, or at least call me out on the malarkey, I would argue that Portugal, Spain, and Switzerland are pivotal to the Nazi economic war machine.
Absolutely. And Lisbon, Portugal, L-I-S-B-O-N, is a very important epicenter for the workings of fascism. No, absolutely. It is remarkable to see these countries described as, quote, neutral, unquote. They're not neutral at all. But that official status gave them a tremendous utility for the Axis, not only Nazi Germany, but Macau will figure significantly in the recycling of the Golden Lily loot that we'll be talking about. Continue, Monty.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, Golden Lily is front and center, as we shall soon see, with Paul Bloom's operations, with Operation Sunrise. But ultimately, there's one final figure that we have to introduce to the listening audience before we can pivot to Paul Bloom and his Japanese intelligence officers. Okay. And he is an SD officer by the name of Zimmer. Last name spelled Z-I-M-M-E-R. Guido Zimmer. First name spelled G-U-I-D-O. Last name spelled Z-I-M-M-E-R. And, Zimmer is a fascinating character in this narrative. Only in the sense that, his proximity to these operations is overlapping with another Nazi intelligence agent that figures prominently into Operation Sunrise, and perhaps we'll get to him at another date. I know we've covered him inside of the Patreon program. But another one of these Nazi intelligence agents that is central to Zimmer's operations with Paul Bloom is a man by the name of Friedrich Schwend. Okay? So.
And Schwend was heavily involved with Operation Bernhard, the counterfeiting of primarily British pound notes, but also American currency. And he was deeply involved with the setting up of the Nazi rat lines, and also tracks forward in American intelligence operations right through the Bay of Pigs. Continue.
Yeah, and it should be noted when we get to the Uyghurs that the commander of the Uyghur insurgent army under Chiang Kai-shek through a front entity called Ming Te Grupa was a man by the name of Gerald Droller. And Jerry Droller had just come off of a stint as an economic warfare officer in the CIA's Switzerland desk in Bern, Switzerland. So there's an interesting continuity here when we talk about Jerry Droller and his activities, and of course Friedrich Schwend. And for the listeners to the Patreon program, which I would highly suggest that the listening audience subscribe to Dave Emery's Patreon. For the listeners to the Patreon program, I have presented a thesis that Jerry Droller and Friedrich Schwend are in fact one and the same person. And I would stress that it's simply a thesis at this point. But I think there's quite a bit of smoke to that fire.
By the way, Henry Kruger in his landmark book of The Great Heroine could also give some credence to that. Go ahead.
Right. So continuing with this document series, this is once again from the Interagency Working Group on Nazi. This is from the Nazi War Crimes Interagency Working Group. And these are from the records of the Central Intelligence Agency. This is a CIA report on an SS officer by the name of Guido Zimmer. Okay. And giving some of his background, it follows from the report from the Director of Historic Research for the National Archives on the Nazi War Crimes Interagency Working Group, or the IWG. And this was written by a professor at American University by the name of Richard Breitman, last name spelled Breitma, and I'll just quote it in its entirety. Guido Zimmer was a mid-level SS officer involved in the Holocaust in Italy and Nazi espionage. His notebooks, when translated in the CIA's file, offer insight into Nazi intelligence activities in the last years of World War II, particularly the Reich Security Main Office, Reichsstag. Efforts either to negotiate a separate peace with the West or to divide the Allies, meaning divide the Americans from the Soviet camp. Zimmer's notebooks, the original in German shorthand, which covered his activities from May 1944 to March of 1945, contain new information about intelligence contacts that led to the surrender of German forces in northern Italy arranged by Alan Dulles, 2 May 1945. Dulles's negotiations, codenamed Operation Sunrise, saved some lives and certainly added luster to his achievements as head of OSS office in Switzerland. The story of the secret American-German negotiations in Switzerland in March and April of 1945 was revealed in 1947 in a series of magazine articles to the Saturday Evening Post. Although the purpose of this publicity was probably to counteract the tenacious and inaccurate Italian accounts of the surrender of German forces in Italy, stories about Dulles' wartime successes helped him later become director of the CIA. Therefore, new evidence about the background of Operation Sunrise is historically quite significant, and we shall see why in a moment. Other significant element of Zimmer's file is that he was able to escape prosecution as a war criminal, partly through exploiting his wartime intelligence contacts and dealings with Alan Dulles, who spoke up for him after the war. In that sense, his history mirrors the experience of other high-level Nazi war officials. Born in 18 November 1911 in Westphalia, Guido Zimmer was a slim, athletic man of average height and dark brown hair and a high-pitched voice. He joined the Nazi Party in 1932 and the SS and the SD in 1936. By 1940, he was a member of the Foreign Intelligence Branch of the Reich's Main Security Command, assigned to Rome and the Vatican. After Zimmer's cover was blown through a slip, he was recalled back to Berlin. In September 1943, after Mussolini was overthrown and a new Italian government tried to sign an armistice, the Allies landed troops in southern Italy. Germany intervened with its own troops and SS and police, taking control of most of the country. Killings and deportations of Jews in Italy began. Once again, I'd like to note that the commander of the deportations of Jews in Italy was Karl Wolff. At least 2 million men, women, and children would be deported into concentration camps under the direct orders of Karl Wolff. Continuing. Zimmer was assigned to Genoa, where he tracked down Jews, and then later Milan. His commander in Milan was the infamous SS Colonel Walter Roth, head of the security police and SD for the Group Northwest Italy, Gruppa Oberleutnant West. Years later...
Ralph, by the way, is also very well known for having set up the mobile gas chambers. These were trucks in which victims were put inside, and the carbon monoxide would exhaust right into the trucks and suffocate them. Walter Ralph was heavily involved in Sunrise, and later went to work for the Galen Org, and was even involved with Allende's Chile and Operation Condor. Amnesty International cited him as being a torture advisor to Augusto Pinochet, one, by the way, of the role models in the book we were talking about on humans, with an endorsement from J.B. Vance, the Republican vice presidential candidate. Continue, Marty.
Right. It should be also noted for the edification of the listening audience, as an editorial, that Walter Roth had been friends with Reinhard Heydrich, going back to when they were both Kriegsmarine lieutenants in the post-World War I environment. So Walter Roth was, in fact, a personal, direct protege of Reinhard Heydrich. And as such, Walter Roth, between 1940 and 1942, right before he's brought into Italy, Walter Roth was the commander of all the Einsatzgruppen, that's mobile death squads, in North Africa, Tunisia, Morocco, and Algeria during the Second World War. He ran all of the mobile death squads in North Africa.
Continue, Marty. Yep.
So ultimately, this Guido talking about, who is the Reich's main security commander's liaison officer to the Vatican in Rome, he is deputy to Walter Roth in this time period. Continuing. Years earlier in Brescia, Criminal Technical Institute, Roth had designed gassing vans to poison Jews and other victims. Zimmer led a small team in Milan that seized Jewish property and lived well off the proceeds. He also obtained political information abroad and built up a network of agents who could supply Germany with intelligence if the Allies were overrun by Italy. One such intelligence conduit was the Japanese minister for the Bank of International Settlements.
Fascinating. And the Bank for International Settlements was basically a very prominent institution that served with impunity as a laundering vehicle for Axis loot and for funds from the West, including the U.S., to the Axis. Continue.
Yes. Ultimately, this man was a Japanese naval officer and a businessman. He was born in 24 February 1907, and he died 18 March 1992. And this man was a lieutenant commander in the Japanese Imperial Navy and a deputy to Yoshio Kodama within the looting of Central Asia. A man by the name of Yoshio Fujimura. And his name is spelled capital Y-O-U, reading again, Y-O-S-H-I-R-O, last name Fujimura. Fujimura, Lieutenant Commander Fujimura.
Okay, continue. And Kodama Yoshio is someone whose importance could not be exaggerated. We've spoken about him at great length, and we will be adding to that great length during the course of this inquiry and the future programs. Continue.
Yeah, so ultimately, I'm quoting, when I'm talking about Fujimura, I'm quoting from, just to give my reference here, this was very interesting. This was from the Bulletin of National Institute of Defense Studies, Volume 17, Number 1. And this was published in 2014. And this was on pages 128 and 131. Okay. So, and I'll just read it in its entirety, the excerpt about Fujimura and what he's doing in Switzerland. Okay. So let's, skip forward to what, Lieutenant Commander, Fujimura is doing in May of 1940. May 1940, Lieutenant Commander Fujimura was in Germany at the University of Magdeburg. That's spelled M-A-G-D-E-B-U-R-G. And in November of the same year, 1940, he was appointed military attaché to the German embassy. When Lieutenant Commander Fujimura took up his post, the military attaché at that time was Tedo Yokio, last name spelled Y-O-K-O-I, who replaced Hideko Chimura, last name spelled K-O-J-I-M-A, during her term. In November of 1943, Fujimura was promoted to lieutenant colonel or lieutenant commander in the Imperial Japanese Navy. In June of 1944, he was transferred to post of aide of military attaché to the Vichy Embassy. And in October of the same year, he also served as military attaché to the German Embassy. So he ultimately had two hats. He was representing the German Embassy for the Japanese and the Vichy French Embassy. In March of 1945, before the Allied invasion of Berlin, he was stationed in Switzerland as the Japanese naval attaché to the Swiss government in Bern. Now, the astute listeners will note, just as a humorous aside, that there is no great body of water in Switzerland. So having a Japanese naval attaché running naval intelligence operations may seem strange, but we'll get to what he's doing. Regarding his transfer to Switzerland, Hideo Kimura, remember, that's the previous Japanese-German attaché, wrote in his post-war recollections that he had intended to go there himself to set up contact with the United States through the German Friedrich Hack, that's last name spelled H-A-C-K, who ultimately was a Sofindis operative that was selling aircraft, a German aircraft, to the Japanese Imperial Navy in the 1920s and 30s. And he was actually also a political scientist and was the liaison officer between Nazi Germany and the Japanese for the Anti-Comintern Pact. And perhaps, Dave, you could tell the audience real quick what the Anti-Comintern Pact was.
It was an alliance or association of various nations, all of them fascist, and it was an anti-communist alliance. It also gave these fascist countries a very marketable front, because this country, as I noted, and as I have noted in many programs, Officer Glenn Pinchback at Fort Sillam, Oklahoma, who had encountered some of the same Nazis that Jim Garrison was investigating in connection with the assassination of JFK, spoke of, quote, a Nazi plot gargantuan in scope to enslave America in the name of anti-communism. And the anti-Comintern was a fascist pact involving Italy, involving Germany, involving Japan, Chiang Kai-shek's China. And it was fascist, but it had as its basic facade. I mean, they were anti-communist, but that gave them a lot of marketability in circles that they otherwise might not have been marketable in.
Correct. So, I appreciate that. So, ultimately, around the end of the Pacific War, through the aforementioned Friedrich Hack, Fujimura had worked hard towards a peace deal with the American forces, primarily with the goal of protecting all Japanese financial assets in the occupied territories. Now, I want to make this very clear. Lieutenant Commander Fujimura is overseeing his part of the secret surrender deal with Alan Dulles and Paul Bloom to protect Japanese financial assets in occupied territories on a global scale.
Okay? And that, of course, tracks right back to the global military operations. Very quickly, Monty, I want to interject. For people who would like to understand Asia, and Americans don't, basically, but one could do, I would say, it is mandatory to assimilate four books by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. One, the Song Dynasty, S-O-O-N-G, then the Marcos Dynasty, the Yamato Dynasty, and Go Warriors. And when you talk about Agent Fujimura, Commander Fujimura, looking to safeguard Japanese economic assets in occupied countries, that is Golden Lily. And the Golden Lily loot is one of the foundational elements of the post-World War II economy in the West. Continue, Lobby.
Right. So, continuing. I'll read that again. Friedrich Hayek had worked hard towards a peace and to end the war of the United States through Alan Dulles, who was the Swiss branch chief of the American Intelligence Agency Office of Strategic Services. Ultimately, there is some conjecture as to whether or not Fujiyama and Hawk worked directly with Alan Dulles or whether they met with him in person. But it has since come to the attention of this researcher that Fujiyama had in fact sent as many as 35 telegrams, but all of them had been suppressed by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So ultimately, what Fujiyama was doing
is it Fujiyama or Fujimura?
Excuse me, Fujimura. Ultimately, what Fujimura was doing was that he was working for the Vice Minister of the Navy through the Naval Intelligence Branch, which at that time was Kodama, to negotiate this secret surrender deal, and that the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Japan was doing everything in his power to block it. So it's rather fascinating that the Japanese government and the foreign affairs staff ultimately did not want this to happen, you know, because the emperor had given an order of total war where every single able body was supposed to fight to the death. You know, bear in mind these secret surrender deals are going on before the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the carpet bombing of Tokyo, and of course the entering of the Russians into the fighting the Japanese at the end of World War II. So these events have not taken place yet. So, reading here, it says that in OSS-related documents that have been intercepted and decoded by the United States were first made public, the veracity of these 35 telegrams began to be questioned by comparison with OSS documents. First, Fujimura states that the first peace telegram was sent out on May 8th, the day of Germany's surrender, but the telegram recorded by the magic intercepts was decoded by record in the United States as dated 5 June. And it is believed that Fujimura may have moved the story forward by 1 month. Regarding the reason for this advance, Tetsuo Arima, last name spelled A-R-I-M-A, speculates, and he's a Japanese historian, speculates that Dulles resigned as head of the OSS Swiss branch on May 28th and left Bern to become the High Commissioner for all American occupied territories, which was not related to intelligence operations, and this may be where he advanced the date to make it consistent with Fujimura's story while negotiating the Dulles agency strategy. Furthermore, Fujiyama wrote in a telegram at the time in May of 1945, Dulles contacted me first, but in a post-war interview, he testified that he had lied out of desperation about that point. So, once again, there is some conjecture here as to who contacted who in this secret surrender deal. But ultimately, Fujiyama and Dulles are working together with Paul Bloom. And according to the American Decoded Records in the Magic summary, all state that the sender of the telegram supposedly sent by Fujimura was Colonel Ichiro Nishihara. All right. And he's also a Swiss military attaché to the Minister of the Navy in Tokyo, to their general staff.
His last name is spelled?
That's last name spelled for Colonel Nishihara is N-I-S-H-I-H-A-R-A.
Nishihara. So, yep, go ahead.
Nishihara. And it's interesting what the essence of this telegram stated. I don't have a direct quote on it. However, I do have the OSS transcript, okay? So this is what Fujimura and Colonel Nishihara had sent to Paul Bloom and Alan Dulles on 8 May 5 June 1945. And it stated roughly the following. President Truman is inferior in his terms of popularity, intelligence, and ability, while he outwardly demands unconditional surrender. He secretly desires an early end to the war in order to increase his popularity and reputation. So, ultimately, this is what Fujimura states about Truman, that his unconditional surrender plan is not popular with Alan Dulles and his compatriots. The second point is that Fujiyama believes that it would not be profitable for the United States to enter into a war with the Soviet Union as allies against the Japanese, because they would lose economic concessions in China. That's a very interesting point. Fujiyama is essentially telling Alan Dulles, look, if you align with the Soviets in China, you're going to lose all your holdings. You know, I should note that the oil company that had exclusive rights to producing all of the oil lamps in China before World War II was the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey.
Yes, indeed. And Smedley Butler, the Marine Corps general, was involved with helping to secure Standard Oil assets in China between the world wars. Go ahead, Marty.
Right. The third point that Fujimura makes to Alan Dulles is the following. Dulles confidently proposed through a trusted third party, presumably referring to Nazi intelligence agent Dr. Huck, that Switzerland, free from Soviet Switzerland, free from Soviet interference, was a suitable location for Japanese negotiations and peace talks between the Japanese military intelligence, the Imperial War Diet, and the United States, and that Dulles would wholeheartedly be in direct contact with President Truman through Secretary of State Stettinius and his deputy, Joseph Grew. Last name on Stettinius is Stettinius. And Joseph Grew's last name is Grew. Okay.
Stettinius, by the way, at one point was Franklin Roosevelt's Secretary of State, closely affiliated with the Morgan-launched U.S. Steel, and later a key operative in the World Commerce Corporation.
And I should also note that Stettinius's father, Edward Stettinius Sr., founded a company called the Foreign Commerce Corporation, very similar name to World Commerce Corporation. Stettinius Sr., as an editorial aside, was business partners of a man by the name of Grayston M.P. Murphy Smith, okay, and an entity called the Foreign Commerce Corporation. And the Foreign Commerce Corporation oversaw all of Standard Oil's holdings in Peking before the Second World War. Okay?
Fascinating. Joseph Grew was the U.S. ambassador to Japan. He was a Morgan protege and someone who was very pro-Japanese and very anti-Chinese. We've spoken about Grew at some length in connection with discussions of the aforementioned Yamato dynasty by Sperling and Peggy Seagrave. Continue.
That's right. So continuing, Alan Dulles would act as a direct contact with President Truman through Secretary of State Stettinius and his deputy Joseph Grew. And if Japan wished to engage in dialogue, he would convey this message to Washington. And if the Japanese side agreed to sending a naval admiral ranked general to Switzerland, he would take responsibility for arranging all the necessary arrangements, including flights to Switzerland, and that it would be desirable for that person to arrive within 2 or 3 weeks. So bear in mind, this is, roughly 2 or 3 weeks after the surrender of the Nazi forces, May 5th, 1945. Dulles also sent the telegram to Washington to the same effect. In addition, Fujimura wrote in this telegram that the Soviet Union proposed to enter the war against Japan at the Yalta Conference and that Roosevelt had agreed as a matter of cooperative policy. In fact, the opposite was true, but that this would have happened in late August. In addition to this, the naval attaché telegram from Bern was sent to Tokyo May 24th, stating that the Soviet Union had promised to enter the war against Japan at the Yalta Conference, and the telegram was sent to Tokyo on June 11, 1945, stating, quote, at the Yalta Conference, The Soviet Union agreed to enter the war if Japan did not surrender by the end of July, end quote, according to the decrypted wiretap records of the Ultra communications stored in MI6. However, Fujimura himself did not leave any clear testimony about obtaining this information about the secret Soviet pact under the war against Japan or sending it to Tokyo. Once again, as a personal editorial aside, I think that he received this information directly from Alan Dulles. So, skipping forward, a second telegram was sent from, July 14th, a second telegram was sent stating that, quote, Dulles and his staff have departed from the United States military headquarters in Frankfurt, and Dulles was informed me that the Japanese government will be available to contact them at any time if they so wish. After this, on the 16th and 17th of July, Dulles sent Fujimura sent two telegrams introducing Dulles' secretary, Gebenitz, and conveying the American views that he had obtained from them.
Is that Gero von Gebenitz?
Absolutely.
A lesson Gavernitz, spoken of at great length in AFA 37, and one of the people with Alan Dulles and Max Egan von Hohenlohe and so forth, working on the Christian West concept. So Gero von Gebenitz, a key person in forging the U.S. Axis alliance in the immediate aftermath of World War II. Really, it began forging during World War II, but after World War II.
Right. And here we have Gebenitz acting as a go-between between Alan Dulles and, of course, Lieutenant Commander, United States Naval Intelligence, Japanese Naval Attaché, Commander Fujimura. So continuing. Gebenitz conveying the American views that Fujimura had obtained from him. The telegram on the 17th of July stated that Japan's defeat was inevitable and that the United States was highly motivated to fight against Japan. It also stated that Dulles was willing to set up a channel of communication with the Japanese to bring about a quick peace. He also stated that it was important to maintain this channel and that Dulles hoped to accomplish something through it, and requested Tokyo's views and instructions. However, the Naval Central Committee left Fujimura's telegram up to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which sent the following telegram to Foreign Affairs Minister Keith Sunjichi in Bern in July 23rd, 1945. Okay, and that minister's last name is spelled, or actually his full name is spelled K-A-S-E, last name spelled S-H-U-N-I-C-H-I, okay? And this is the telegram that was sent. Quote, recently, your naval attaché has offered me, through a reliable third party, a certain Dulles, Roosevelt's special envoy. I should note that Dulles is not Roosevelt's special envoy.
No. He was part of the U.S. intelligence contingent, but not only was betraying Roosevelt, I personally think Roosevelt was assassinated, and that helped to set the stage for the Axis joining with the U.S. And maybe, of course, Alan Dulles was heavily involved with the assassination of JFK. Continue.
In fact, I would argue that there were at least three people that were assassinated by, fascist elements that are friendly to Dulles' position, President Roosevelt, General Patton, and, Secretary of Defense, Forrestal. I believe that all three of these men were murdered because they tried to do something to stop this pact with fascist elements. But continuing with the telegram sent by Case Sinchuchi. Recently, your naval attaché offered me, through a reliable third party, a certain Dulles, Roosevelt's special envoy, and that if the Japanese side intends to hold secret talks with the United States in Washington, I will convey this to the Washington government. And if Tokyo sends a high-ranking naval attaché to Switzerland, I will take care of the aircraft and other preparations. So I have requested that you take action. The Central Naval Office, after contacting us, has responded that, quote, in light of the enemy's frequent plots and attempts to rile up the enemy, and the fact that their main target seems to be the Navy, the central office does not intend to take up this matter. So we should closely monitor this type of operation in close contact with Japanese authorities stationed in Switzerland. And that left the matter to, reading again, and has left the matter to the Foreign Ministry, or Ministry of Foreign Affairs. I would like your naval attaché to provide more details on this matter. I would also like you to immediately telegraph your views on this matter, including your outlook on the reliability of this person, Dulles, and whether you can find out his true intentions of the United States regarding the peace issue through other parties. And this was actually from a article called Dulles' Operations in Switzerland, the East Asian War Incident, the End of Sweden, Switzerland, and the Vatican. And that was actually a direct quote from the Telegram, an English translation, albeit, but a direct quote from the Telegram. So skipping forward a little bit to the American perspective of these operations, it states the following. The first OSS document that mentions Fujimura's peace efforts was a report sent to the Joint Chiefs of Staff on June 4th, 1945, the day after Fujimura had sent his first telegram. In it, Fujimura reported that he had direct secret telegraphic contact with the Navy Central Committee under General Kodama. That's actually Admiral Kodama, but in the report it says General, and had earned their trust, and that Navy circles were in favor of peace, and that the condition for peace was the retention of the emperor, and that Japan was not self-sufficient in food and was dependent on Korea for rice and sugar, and it was necessary to secure all rice and sugar imports out of Korea.
Really? That places the whole Korean embroglio in a very in a much deeper context. Continue that, Marty.
I will read that for your listening audience once again. In the secret surrender report that was sent to the Joint Chiefs of Staff on June 4th, Lieutenant Commander Fujimura, who was working with Paul Bloom and Alan Dulles during Operation Sunrise for a secret Japanese surrender deal, literally states that his two top conditions are the retention of the Emperor of Japan, meaning that he would maintain his office, and that all rice and sugar imports from Korea would be protected.
That is fascinating, just fascinating. I mean, it just because we've got a little, about 7 minutes left in this interview. One of the things I want to remind the audience of, not only was the emperor retained, but the book The Yamato Dynasty by the Seagraves, the maneuvering by MacArthur and the American occupation forces in Japan to not only retain the emperor, but to absolve him of any war guilt were enormous. And the number one financial institution for exfiltrating the enormous wealth that the emperor had at his disposal was the Yokohama Specie Bank. The emperor owned 25% in that. That later was renamed the Bank of Tokyo. And one of its top officials was Isuke Ono, the father of Yoko Ono, who was a Japanese naval intelligence banking paymaster for Axis spies in the U.S. in 1933, which is fascinating. We'll develop that at greater length. So, that is really interesting, Marty, and it also, again, it places the entire Korean War.
the entire damn war in a completely different light. Why were we there? Yeah.
why were you there? And again, you've got Colonel David Dean Rusk as one of the people who helps to split Korea at the 38th parallel. We will get into the what I have still called the hidden history of the Korean War. And General Kim Suk-won, General Arisu, whom we haven't even gotten into. One of the observations you have made, Monty, about my research, which I'm about to begin my 46th year on the air, it is Eurocentric. And
right.
One of the things that I am looking to do in this series, which will be a long one, the pivot to Asia, so to speak, borrowing the term from Barack Obama, whose heritage goes to the Indonesian massacre of the mid-60s, but that's another story. Dissociated from this, but is
not
to,
at all, unfortunately.
It is to show that what we did vis-a-vis the Axis in Europe, also we did in Asia, and that is so much the foundation, really the substance of all of the BS we're hearing now about China this, China that, China the other thing, and it just, the people running this country, the people in charge, the power brokers, they have betrayed not only the American people, but I think it was someone that grew up watching Victory at Sea and other things on television. The soldiers, sailors, and army airmen who died in World War II were fundamentally betrayed by the leadership of this country. And it is staggering to me to learn the reality of what was really going on. And there aren't many things that will render me inarticulate, but obviously this is one of the things that does. And part of the inarticulation is the fact that if I were to really give vent to my own subjective assessment of this, I would have to reach into the foulest backwaters of my vocabulary, and this would absolutely run afoul of FCC regs. But you know, they talk about, you know, Brady Woods, you know, the F bomb, the S bomb, and so forth. If you want to talk about real obscenity with a capital R and a capital O, that's what we're talking about here. It's just wild.
Once again, to put that obscenity in true historical context, it should be noted that there were at least 15 million Chinese slave laborers inside of the Japanese concentration camp system. 15 million. And well over 30 million Chinese civilians would be massacred under intelligence operations headed by General Arisu and Yoshio Kodama. So let's put this in the proper context. This is genocide. These are genocidal madmen that we are talking about here, okay?
Here in San Jose, California, with the capital of the Silicon Valley, they just dedicated the park to the late Iris Chang, and I do not believe for one minute that her, quote, suicide, unquote, was anything of the kind. She was working on a book and documentary about the Bataan Death March. One of the key enablers of that was Tsuji, the aforementioned Tsuji, Tsuji Masanobu, Masanobu, a deputy to Arisu, and like so many of these Axis war criminals, went to work for the U.S. after the war. And
specifically after the war, can you read me the last name on that again?
I'll give you the name. We are almost out of time. We're down the last minute and a half. S-T, capital T-S-U-J-I, first name, last name, capital Masanobu.
Yeah, specifically, he was the commander of all ratline and stay-behind units into North Korea during the Korean War.
Fascinating. So, and Iris Chang was talking about the Bataan Death March, and one of the many things that Masanobu did was he actually ate the corpses of some of the people who died in that. And as she was unpacking the recollections of veterans of the Bataan Death March, one can but wonder if some of them had actually seen some of that. In any event, we will be exploring this at greater length in many programs to come. We are, for all practical purposes, out of time. And again, I want to apologize to you, Monty, when I interrupt to make sure that we have a source or the spelling of a name. It's
not
for the
all
purposes of clarity and audience understanding. And
absolutely.
That should be understood. Also, there will be a new flash drive available sometime later this fall. We're almost into the fall. And that will have all of the conversations with Monty, including this one. And this concludes For the Record program number 1346, Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 20. For Monty, this is Dave Emery saying, thanks for listening.